Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays.
Well, hey guys, it's Anna David here with After Party Pod. Hi, the podcast all about addiction and recovery and mental health. And God, today we get into an aspect of addiction and recovery that has been neglected thus far. And I'm talking love addiction and sex addiction. We do so much drug and alcohol talk, and we don't talk about this enough. We really don't talk about gambling enough. I don't think we talk about debting enough either. I mean, these are all good goals for 2015 to be incorporated into the show. Speaking of 2015, hey, hi there. Welcome to this year. How is it going? Did you do resolutions? Did you have a good New Year's Eve or a bad New Year's Eve, or was it in between? I'll tell you, I was trying to figure out, you know, how do my sober New Year's Eves compare to my unsober New Year's Eves, thinking that of course I would tally them and I would realize that the sober ones were a billion times better. And I came to this disturbing conclusion, which is that I never really had a good New Year's Eve, like ever. I'm not even kidding. I mean, some were not terrible, but not good. And this one, it was great. So I want to say it was my best one ever, but that's also, as you know now, there wasn't a lot of competition. It was really, really nice. A couple friends and I went to Jeff Kober's house. Now, he is a previous podcast guest. He was an early guest, and he teaches Vedic meditation here in Los Angeles, which is the kind of meditation that I do. And he learned from Tom Knowles, who was my teacher, and he's the most wonderful guy. And so he does a thing at his house where there is a puja ceremony. Go Google it if you don't know what it means, because I can't describe it. And so we went over there, and you drink chai tea, and he hands you this, there's this blank sheet of paper, and you have to make a list of 108 things you're grateful for. And 108 is a very significant number in the spiritual realm. And again, you'll have to Google that, because I can't remember why it's significant. There were so many reasons having to do with planets and length from the earth and all sorts of stuff that sort of flitted in my ear and the brain didn't grab a hold of it in a way that it could be repeated. So anyway, and it was interesting to make that list, because I'm a semi-regular gratitude list maker, but never have I made one that was that long, you know, where 108 is a long time, and so a lot of things to put on it. And so one of the things that I experienced and other people around me experience was that you get to a certain number, you kind of power through, and then you're at 40. Oh my God, I had 40 things I was grateful for. And then you're going, I don't have a 41st. I mean, there's no way that I'm going to come up with more. And then you think of something, and then that spurs other things, and you're at 80 or whatever. And I made it. And there were some pretty random things on it. And Jeff said before the ceremony that was the whole point of the exercise, that you do it, you think you're at the end, and then you get in a flow. And much like we can get in a good flow in terms of our mental, in terms of the way we think, in terms of sobriety, in terms of so many things, it's a positive metaphor. Anyway, then you meditate from 11:50 to 12:10. And so that means at midnight you hear all the fireworks and things going off. It's kind of great. And I was annoyed because I'm not a group meditator, so people rustling around always drives me insane, which is not obviously the way you're supposed to feel. But I did something I've never done, which is that I was so annoyed by it, by a certain person rustling around, that I opened my eyes so I could find the enemy and focus on and make sure it was who I thought it was. It wasn't actually who I thought it was. But what was interesting is that even though I did that, all my people around me came out of the meditation really tired and going like, ugh, I almost fell asleep. I just want to go to bed. And it was like I had done ecstasy. I was so happy and laughy and energized. It was really weird. I don't know what the recommendation is here, if there's a moral to the story. I don't think there is. So let me move on to today's guest, Ethely Ann Vair, one of the smartest women you're going to encounter. Smart, funny, and is an expert on love and sex addiction, having a self-taught expert, having experienced the pain and suffering of being that way, finding recovery. And she has an amazing ability to sort of break it down for the layman or laywoman and talk about it in a way that has a lot of information, but it also is anecdotal. And so it's very, very easy to relate to. And it's done in a totally non-judgmental, open way. And she comes by this ability, honestly. She's been a successful writer for a long time. She's published 10 or 11 books. We could not figure it out in this conversation, but so many that she doesn't actually know. She's written on CSI, VIP, VIP, whatever. God, you know what I mean. And she was an on-camera entertainment television person and was like a big rock reporter back in the day and did reviews for The Hollywood Reporter and The Times and Elle and all of this stuff. So that's who you're about to listen to. Brace yourself. It's good. She's also sober from drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, all that. But, you know, that kind of takes a back seat to the main topic of sex and love. So here you go, Ethely Ann Vair.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh, my God. I think my copy has, like, bloodstains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Okay, so we may have just hired you as a writer, which is an exciting way to start a podcast.
That's what I do for a living, not to worry.
No, but I think that that's a great idea. So we were just talking about you doing an advice column, which you do on your blog, and it's great.
Thank you. When people ask questions, it gives me an opportunity. The nice thing about doing a column would be that people know they can send their questions there.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they always know that they can send a question to affection deficit disorder.
Right.
So, yeah, the thing is that it's, you know, I say it's advice to the crazy lovelorn. It's like, let's take your typical, I'm asking for relationship advice, and let's look not at the problem being him or the problem being the relationship. Let's look at perhaps the problem is you.
Right.
And let's do a fourth column
right.
on your question.
Right. Right. I mean, I will say it is so hard to get people to ask questions. I used to be on a television show that people watched and we would have to make up the questions.
Wow.
It's so hard. You know, we used to have, Jane Velez Mitchell answering questions right. on The Fix. And we couldn't get questions.
It's hard to get questions.
Yeah.
And yet I did that Ask Me Anything thing on Jezebel.
Yeah.
And there were like 127 questions in the space of 30 minutes, and I couldn't possibly get to them all. So
right.
I think when the floodgates open, when people yeah. see that other people, and it's again that, oh my God, I'm not alone thing. When other people are asking questions, you get so many like, oh, me too. And so they'll just come in a deluge.
So that was a live thing.
Yes.
What about doing a Twitter chat?
I'd be happy. I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah. And you're great at talking about it. So let's talk about the history of that. So your topic is love addiction.
Right.
And when did you first, when did you first become aware of the fact that you were, in fact, a love addict?
Well, I think it was when, you know, I was banging this 19-year-old with zero sobriety on the bathroom floor of his recovery house.
Wow.
And one of my friends said, why didn't you bring him home? And I said, you don't think I'm going to let him in my house, do you? And she's like, okay, you'll have sex with him.
Right.
But you wouldn't let him know where you live. Are
right.
you beginning to see, and I'm going, huh? I'm sorry, what?
Right.
But he's hot. Don't you understand? And I was just beginning to see that maybe I was insane. you know, that maybe
how long ago
I was
that?
Insane. This was almost 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm,
it was probably close to 20 years ago. And right in that area, a therapist, after I ended my second heartbreaking affair with a married man, never thinking that it might be breaking the hearts of their wives, because who cares about that? It's me and my needs and me, and I'm so unhappy, and I'm not getting the whole loaf. I'm settling for crumbs, and what's wrong with me? And I was sent to therapy by someone who cared about me. She said, run, do not walk to therapy, because this is not acceptable behavior. I went, huh?
Right.
But I did go to therapy, and at one point, the therapist said, have you ever read anything about sex and love addiction? Are you familiar with the concept of sex and love addiction? And when I started studying it and started talking to other people who were in recovery from sex and love addiction, I went, oh, my God.
Right.
That's me. I am intoxicated by infatuation. I have fantasy relationships. I have relationships with people who are not having a relationship with me.
Right.
I have relationships that are 95% in my head. I'm always living in the past. Oh, if only I had, if he had, we, I could have, I should have, or in the future, oh, this is going to be, and that's going to be, and it just every aspect of the disease of addiction. And I came to learn that it is chemically motivated, and that it is an addiction exactly the same way that my cocaine addiction was an addiction. It is a physical addiction. And I became so aware of the craving to hear his voice and how that was exactly like jonesing for a drug.
Mm-hmm.
And that, oh, that exhale when I heard that voice, that it was exactly like getting a like inhaling a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
Inhaling a cigarette when I was having a cigarette craving, that was exactly the physical feeling when I would hear his voice after stressing for I don't know how many hours that I hadn't heard from him. And I started really seeing this as a physical addiction, mental obsession, a spiritual malady, the whole bit. It's exactly a cognate of any other substance addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I started working on my own recovery, and I started getting some time and some actual recovery and a little bit of wisdom. And I would tell people stuff because I'm a busybody, and people would say, oh, you should write about this. You really have to write about this. People, you know, so many people want to know more about this. So I started writing the blog, Affection Deficit Disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about a year, I was approached, do I want to write a book about it? So I wrote the book, Love Addict, Sex, Romance, and Other Dangerous Drugs, because that's what they are.
Well, so for listeners, how can they tell what is, you know, being excited? You know, I think a lot of people who don't have love addiction think a lot about the person that they like and get really excited when they hear that person's voice. So how do they know whether or not it classifies as addiction? And I know it's self-defined, like self-diagnosed, like I'm sure a lot of, you know, a lot of
there
diseases.
Are signs and symptoms, right? Symptoms is the self-diagnosed. Sign is what other people can see. Like, yes, everybody's going to get buzzed on champagne too.
Right.
But people are some people will pick up a cigarette every now and again.
Right.
When you are going out in the snow in your slippers to the 7-Eleven to get a pack of cigarettes, or when you are, you know, saying, I'm not going to have another drink. Okay, maybe one more. And waking up with a hangover again.
Right.
And that whole sort of pounding on the bar, how did this happen one more time?
Right.
When you start seeing that behavior in your romantic life too, that's the difference. There's a difference between, you know, having a crush on a guy and stalking him on the internet. There's a difference between checking someone's Facebook page and obsessively looking at all of the connections of all of the women who have ever looked at his Facebook page.
Right.
And there's some behavior that's perfectly appropriate when you're 17 and totally inappropriate when you're 37.
And so what are some other signs? Are there other signs?
Oh, I have a list. Would you like me to? I should have brought my bookmark one.
Your cheat sheet.
I have a cheat sheet one that tells me where my different things are. Now, see, I think, to me, there are three kinds of sex and love addiction, right? There's your infatuation addict who loves that getting to know you. Oh, I just love that first blush of it. So intoxicating.
Right.
Then there's the relationship junkie, mm-hmm. which, as I say, she's the punchline of the joke of what do you tell a woman with two black eyes? Nothing, you already told her twice.
Right, right.
Horrible old joke, but I not only know women like that, I've been that woman.
Yeah.
You know, that,
yeah.
The relationship, that bonding, that sense of feeling that someone else is completing you, that, mm-hmm. that you will die rather mm-hmm. than be alone.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you do die mm-hmm. because, you know, domestic partners kill domestic partners mm-hmm. all the time. And then there's the sex addict that's into the pursuit and the ritual of pursuit and the pursuit of the orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the signs mm-hmm. I have, it's like, do you check his Facebook page before you check your Facebook page?
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
That is a sign. Do you leave a second or third or fourth voicemail message
yeah.
when the first message has not been returned because maybe he didn't get it.
Right. His phone may be broken.
His phone may be broken. Mm-hmm. Lost the phone. Phone's not charged. He's shy and needs encouragement. Maybe you dialed wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe you forgot to leave your callback number. Maybe he called and you missed it. Maybe the message got lost in the ether.
Sometimes that can happen.
It can happen.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Often more than once.
Yeah.
Yes. Have you ever changed your route home to pass your love object's house?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever parked outside and waited to see if another woman comes in? This works for both genders, by the way. Feel
right.
free to flip genders.
Yeah.
I just happen to be talking to a woman here.
Yeah.
Do you know your lover's email password or voicemail?
Yeah.
Have you ever checked
yeah.
your lover's email or voicemail? Not a good sign. And then little stuff like, do you develop an instant fondness for a hobby or musical genre you found abhorrent only days
right.
earlier?
Right.
I love to sail. Sailing is great. I get seasick, but never. Oh,
right.
no. Sail. I love to sail. Let me see. Does it hurt a little when you learn that any attractive person, even a person you don't actually know, has gotten married to someone who wasn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, George Clooney?
Right.
Really?
Right.
Really?
Right. And I relate to that one.
You never even gave me a chance.
Yeah.
But we could, you
yeah.
know. Have you ever worked in a job that requires partial nudity?
Interesting. Yeah.
Let me see. How long is your life list of sex partners? If it hits the three figures, think about it. By the way, the fact that you keep a life list
well,
of
I was
sex
gonna
partners
say,
kind of a clue.
Don't you think a lot of sex addicts probably don't?
No, actually, I think a lot of sex addicts do.
That's fascinating.
I think they really like, yes, I think they grade them,
right.
color code, stars, all that,
wow.
yes, and never want to be away from their phone, always leave forwarding addresses because he or she might be trying to find you,
mm-hmm.
that perfect someone who's just going to fill that deep existential hole and make it okay,
mm-hmm.
the key to your lock. That
right.
person that's going to hug you so tight, they're going to put all the broken pieces back together.
Yeah.
That person may be looking for you.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to be found.
Yeah.
yes. And then, then the other is, of course, you really believe you can save that stripper, convict, biker, serial philanderer, suicide survivor,
mm-hmm.
alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
with the depth and purity of your love.
Yeah.
Yes.
What about, here's one that I do relate to. That I feel like could be added to the list is the sheer rage you feel when you're waiting to hear from someone and it's a text from like your friend.
Oh, it's that the disappointment.
Well, and there's the rage at the friend.
Oh, how dare you?
Yeah.
Yes, how dare it be you? I'm waiting to. Oh, yes, I totally get that.
That's a good one.
Yeah, and that leaping for the phone, like as I say, it's a pot boiling over for a stove.
Yeah,
I mean, I would just like dive across a room to grab a ringing phone.
Yeah, but I wonder if it's like, you know, the 20 questions for alcoholism. It's like if you check, you know, six or more on Epley's list of signs, you are, if you check all of them, you know, you may be, you are, whatever.
I would say that if you relate too much to more than a couple of them, you should look at it.
Yeah.
You think about it. There are grown-up lists that actual therapists conduct. Mine is, you know.
Yours is way more fun.
Yes, mine's done in a fun way. But, for instance, I have passed over family, social, or career opportunities in favor of romantic or sexual ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I consistently choose partners who are emotionally, geographically, or logistically unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
I often feel an instant connection connection to mm-hmm. someone I have just met. Mm-hmm. I have hidden or lied about my romantic or sexual adventures from friends and family, mm-hmm. fearing they wouldn't approve or understand. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid I will never find someone to love. I don't like to be alone. I use sex to hook prospective romantic partners. I mean, this is the more, you know, this is actually 25 questions, which are in my book, which I cribbed from the actual questions. Professionals.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I'm a hobbyist in this area.
But I mean, if you can speak to the masses in a way that they can understand, isn't that so much more helpful?
Well, that's kind of the idea.
Yeah.
I bring a lot of anecdotal or what they call empirical evidence to the table.
Experiential.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So, I mean, I would love to also talk about, you know, drug addiction, alcoholism, nicotine addiction, yep. all of it, yep. you know, because you span the whole spectrum with these, right?
I think the only program I don't qualify for is Gamblers Anonymous.
Yeah.
I just never wanted to spend the money.
Yeah. I know. I wonder if DA and Gamblers Anonymous are, you know, that there's not a lot of crossover, the Venn diagram between
interesting.
The two.
Interesting. Because I don't really qualify for DA
right.
either.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I'm healthy around money, mm-hmm. perhaps, the only area, goodness knows why.
I feel like that, and I'm speaking out of turn, it's just purely my opinion. But while a lot of the diseases are genetically predisposed, and who knows, that's a whole other topic we can get into, but DA feels like it has so specifically to do with how you are raised, that you may not be born a debtor or whatever, but I feel like all my money issues and the money issues I think that a lot of people I know have are about how their parents handled money, how they were taught about money.
Yes, I think that that's a good notice. And I think it's, I mean, addiction is, you know, I have a pathological relationship to my own body chemistry.
Yeah.
Right? I can be an adrenaline junkie. People can dope themselves up on their own adrenaline with rage,
mm-hmm.
or they can dope themselves up on high-risk sports, which, mm-hmm. You know, I dive with sharks, I jump out
you
of airplanes.
Do?
I'll do anything.
Wow.
I love that stuff. Although, as time has gone by and as my recovery has progressed, I'm a little less in love with that spike of adrenaline, like a little more mellow serotonin buzz,
mm-hmm.
but I still have a pathological mm-hmm. relationship to my own body chemistry. Money doesn't get me high,
mm-hmm.
so I don't
Spending?
Continue to pursue it. Not really. I always care about the value of something,
mm-hmm.
the durability of something. And that, I think, is because of how I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that someone else, money gets them high, they're going to have issues around money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, winning at the get. My mother was a gambling addict.
Mm-hmm.
She would pursue that incredible, great feeling of winning at the roulette table to the gates of insanity and death. That got her so high, she kept after it.
Right.
I had cocaine. I didn't need roulette.
Cocaine's so much better than roulette. I mean,
They're both fairly expensive.
You know, but for the years that cocaine works, it's like hitting black 14 or whatever you want over and over and
it's
over
true.
Again.
And it keeps you thin.
Yeah, never kept me that thin. Well, because I did the bad Coke diet, which is to say that I would do it for a couple days and then I would eat everything in creation for the next 2 days.
Consistency
helped. You know, did you do it when you...
Oh, I weighed 103 pounds. Today, I...
That's not even healthy.
No,
I mean,
it's totally not unhealthy.
Yeah.
No, I was 5'6" tall,
yeah.
103 pounds. I currently am at a healthy 135.
Right.
Okay, maybe a little more. Let's not quibble.
Right.
Maybe I could lose a little, but a healthy weight for my frame is 125 to 135.
Yeah.
103 is Dachau.
Do you have food issues?
I like to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so my food issue is a cultural issue. It's that I am extremely attractive for 1911. I'm
right.
not that attractive for 2015.
Oh, stop
I'm
it.
A
You're
little,
gorgeous.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I always like to hear that. But yes, we just happen to be in an era and in a town where it is considered appropriate to be considerably underweight.
Yeah.
And I like to eat too much to starve myself.
Yeah.
So that's my food issue. I am not willing to make the sacrifice required to appeal to the vanity I have.
Well, I would say that that's the opposite of a food issue.
Okay.
Right? If you're not willing to subscribe to the societal demands and you're willing to just, hey, this is how I'm going to be about it. I diagnose you as not having food issues.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I do know that the my part in it is I resent your societal demands.
Right.
I resent your standards.
Right, right.
My part in the resentment, I don't want to eat less.
Yeah. So when did you first do Coke?
Let me see. It was, I made it through college without, it was right after I got out of college. So we're talking about the 1970s. We mm-hmm. still bought Coke by the spoon.
What?
Yes.
I've never even heard of that.
Coke by the spoon. That was it was $50 worth at the time. So it would have been about half a gram, I would say.
It's a big old spoon.
Maybe it was a quarter gram.
But
cocaine was expensive in the 1970s.
So wait a second. The spoon was open?
No, it wasn't physically a spoon.
Okay, that's what I was picturing.
It was still in a bindle. It was just called a spoon.
Okay, and so it was either
a half a gram
or something.
I think at some point someone must have measured it out in actual measuring spoons.
Yeah. So, and how much was a spoon?
$50.
Jeez, I was buying it in the 90s for that. A gram.
Yes, it was expensive. Cocaine was expensive. It was rare. It was unusual. It was extremely elitist.
And
it was a movie star drug.
Better Coke.
Probably.
Clean and good. I don't know.
When I sold it, we cut the hell out of it. So if you were buying from me, you weren't getting it clean and good. I'll tell you that.
So how did you go from doing it, trying it, to doing it, to selling it?
Why, becoming addicted to a man, of course.
Oh, really?
The one who blacked my eyes, the one who set me up as a topless dancer, because I would bring more money into the house, and I did everything he wanted for fear of losing him, because, God forbid, you should lose a man. It made you an absolute failure and unwanted and mm-hmm. undesirable and mm-hmm. unlovable and alone and just couldn't possibly face that. So, I hooked up with my dealer mm-hmm. and ended up in the penitentiary.
Talk about that. I didn't know that till I read your Wikipedia this morning.
I know. I clean up really well, don't
you
I?
You sure do.
I am. Yes, I'm an award-winning author. I am in the who's who of American women.
Yeah. What a story.
And yes, I graduated from the University of California at Santa Barbara and the California Institute for Women.
And so how long did you go away for?
It was really only about 9 or 10 months in mm-hmm. all. I was arrested for possession with intent to sell. Mm-hmm. We were arrested when we had ordered a kilo of hash from England mm-hmm. and they sent it by mail mm-hmm. because it was the 70s mm-hmm. and people just weren't thinking very straight. Everybody was really, really high in the 70s.
But I know people who sent Coke by mail in the 90s.
Right.
Well,
it doesn't smell as much as hash does.
True.
So, yes, the dog sniffed. And this was international, right? Mm-hmm. So the dog sniffed it out at custom, and they delivered the package, and we accepted delivery of the package. This was me and my dope dealer husband. Mm-hmm. And
you married him.
Oh, yes. Of course.
So,
he asked. You don't say no to someone who asks you to marry them.
And so wait,
I never figured that out, that you could say no to someone who asked you.
How many times have you been married?
Three.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Technically four, but the first one was annulled, mm-hmm. and we never lived together or had an actual real, I don't think I know his middle name.
So that was pre-drug dealing marriage?
That was at college. That was I don't need no stinking badges, teenage rebellion marriage.
Okay.
He needed American citizenship.
Right.
I said, I'll marry you, what the heck, who
cares?
Yeah,
and you were dating him, though?
No.
Oh,
no, I'd never met him.
Oh, my God.
I met him once.
Did you get good money?
He was supposed to give me money, but he never did.
Wow. Okay. So I do not count that. But
So then it's three.
So you and the husband.
So me and the dope dealer. Mm-hmm. So me and the dope dealer got busted, mm-hmm. and they found all kinds of drugs in the house. Mm-hmm. And he, sweet, loyal, wanted to never marry your dope dealer because the first thing he said was, "They're hers," mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. of course. And so trial, and I didn't want everybody said, separate your case from his. He's not out. He's only dragging you down. And I said, oh, no, we're in love. You don't understand. We're in love.
Right.
We're married. We had been married for 9 days, by the way. And I never saw him again. After 9 days of marriage, I never saw him again because they sent us to separate institutions. He went to Tracy. I went to CIW. Mm-hmm. I'm like 19 years old at the time or something. I'm just still just
so you were in college, or you graduated early?
I graduated young. I was very smart and very stupid at the same time. And they sent us to different institutions, and the state of California confiscated the letters that we wrote to one another because we were considered crime partners, and they don't let crime partners correspond with one another. I didn't know that. I thought he had abandoned me, wasn't writing me, didn't love me anymore, and thank God, because if I had actually gotten all of his manipulative drug dealer, I love you, precious baby letters, I probably would have stayed with him, and I would be dead by now. So they didn't let us communicate with each other. I did 6 months in the observation. They put you in for 90 days. They put me in for 90 days in the penitentiary to see if I was penitentiary material, or because it was a first offense and I was so young, if they were going to let it go as a less of a crime. And I ended up being sentenced to a year in civil brand, a year in county jail. And actually, I think most people would rather do 3 years in the penitentiary than a year in civil brand, because it was a hole. I mean, it was the black hole of Calcutta at the time. I think the city got sued for the conditions there and finally tore it down decades ago.
What was it like?
It was gray concrete. You wore a denim shift and shower sandals, flip-flops. You know, everything was open. Showers were open. Toilets were open. You were being viewed by the guards at all times. You weren't allowed to touch anyone. Physical contact was against the rules. So you were all, you know, starving babies, right? You know, there was... the food was diabolical, as you can imagine. Most people had to work in the kitchen. I had to work in the kitchen. One day I remember dropping the huge, big pan of mashed potatoes and being given a dustpan and a broom to sweep them back up, put them back in the pan, and serve them to the inmates. You never saw the sun. You had 1 hour a week when you were able to go outside, but usually there weren't enough guards to let anyone out, so you didn't get your hour outside. So everyone's skin turned to oatmeal because of the bad food and the lack of sun. You weren't allowed any cosmetics or to do anything with your hair because that was considered changing your appearance and a precursor to an attempt at escape.
Oh my God.
You had all of these women overcrowded, starved for any kind of human contact, given no privacy, herded essentially like animals, fed crap. Worked fairly hard, and they weren't even allowed to, you know, curl their hair. The things that women did to amuse themselves were, I'll always remember, we would make false eyelashes out. We would pluck hairs out and take thread and make little make-believe false eyelashes. We had no actual way to attach to our faces, but just the idea of creating false eyelashes was, it was like a little wedding trousseau for these convicts, all wearing ill-fitting, faded denim shifts, shapeless shifts, and shower sandals. It was the most demoralizing, the absolutely most demoralizing situation. And when I got out of jail, you know, I said, I am never, ever going to do drugs again. I would never, ever risk being put back in that situation again.
Okay, but you were not put in that situation again.
I was never put back in jail, but I sure as heck went back to...
Didn't stick with that.
Went back to... It was like, I could never, ever do drugs. Okay, maybe just a line.
So how long did that last from I could never to the line?
Probably about 6 or 7 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you were completely clean?
No, I didn't know anything about program. I didn't know anything about abstinence. I just knew that I shouldn't do any illegal drugs because I didn't want to get arrested again. So I was scared straight in the way that they thought back then that this was supposed to work. You're supposed to just put the fear of God in everybody and they'll straighten up and fly right in. They'll just say no. And so I still drank. I had no idea that there was a disease called alcoholism and that one of the ways it manifested itself was in drug use. So I still drank. I still shagged everything in sight because that felt good. You know, I still married another man whom I... Let me see. I was on a date with one guy when I met this guy. The guy that I met on the date came home with me that night and never left for 8 years.
Wow.
So that was my second marriage.
Was that a good marriage at
that?
Yeah,
it was pretty good, all things considered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was pretty good, all things considered, when we have a fabulous son who's
I know him.
Ah, he's the best.
I met him, such a sweetheart, yeah.
He and his wife and my new little grandbaby were staying with me for the holidays.
Uh-huh.
My son lets me say that he has about 13 years, I think, in Al-Anon.
Yeah.
Of wonderful recovery. He met his wife in the rooms.
Mm-hmm.
We both don't smoke together.
I know. That's how I knew him, from quitting smoking.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He is the best. So I would never undo that marriage,
yeah,
because it produced that amazing boy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Pretty much despite my best efforts, I think. Although I did get clean and sober when he was 10.
Mm-hmm.
So from the age of 10 on, he's had pretty darn consistent environment.
And how long are you sober then?
I'll be 27 in March.
Wow. And how long are you sober from sex and love?
About 15 years,
mm-hmm,
but I don't count days in that program because my essential bottom line being a self-determined abstinence, because
mm-hmm,
like with food addiction, with love addiction, you have to love,
yeah,
right? You have to eat. So you have to define some sort of abstinent behavior that works,
mm-hmm,
for you. So at first my abstinent behavior was, you know, don't sleep with married men,
mm-hmm,
don't have sex with someone on the first date,
mm-hmm,
don't call guys unless they've called me.
Mm-hmm.
And then as time's gone on, my sort of bottom line now is be in the present.
Mm-hmm.
No fantasizing, no going back over the past, or no projecting about the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much impossible to do perfectly on a daily basis.
Right, right.
But I'm pretty good at noticing it,
mm-hmm,
when my little old balloon starts, you know, my little brain balloon,
mm-hmm,
starts flying off into the, I wonder if he's, and could we, and what would I, as soon as I start going,
mm-hmm,
there, I'd be like, okay, let's pull it back, Ethelie,
right,
pull it back.
Right, right. So does that mean the first bottom lines you don't have to subscribe to, or you added to the bottom lines?
I added to the bottom lines.
Okay, yeah. And
yeah, I have not had sex with a married man for more than 15 years.
That's something.
One shouldn't have to be proud of that.
One should not, but that's something. I went through that once, and it was so painful that I will. And for me, not again. Didn't really think about the wife,
right?
But I feel like I wouldn't ever do it again. But you know, no, I mean, I never would. It was a while ago. But God, you know, it's amazing how seductive that was.
Oh, married men are the best.
Jesus.
For one, we love addicts. I'm going to include you just out of courtesy. I'm not saying you are.
Yeah, I was very happy not to relate to most of the signs. I'll tell you that.
To the general public, we love addicts.
Yeah.
We tend to want to enmesh, but we don't really want to be intimate. We're
right.
really afraid of deep intimacy because we tend to have all this self-loathing stuff,
mm-hmm,
all churning away inside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, come close, come close, come close, not that close.
Well,
right?
Yeah.
And so married men are great,
yeah,
because you never have to worry about them actually marrying you.
Right, right,
right. You never have to really show up for the tough stuff. You get all the fun stuff. You get all the lingerie and champagne and chocolates.
Right.
You don't have to pay the bills or change the diapers.
Right.
This is good.
So, and isn't it sort of the inverse? I mean, isn't the avoidance part just an inverse of the love
absolutely.
Part?
Absolutely.
You know? So what do you think of the Pia Melody books?
I think that she doesn't really express. She may get it, but
mm-hmm,
I don't see in her books a real understanding that it's all the same person. That there isn't this love avoidant, usually a man,
yeah,
who is desperately trying to shake you off his ankle,
right,
as he's trying to leave the room, and that there's a woman clutching someone's ankle because she's so desperately codependent.
Right.
I think that when you get tired of clutching someone's ankle after a while, you get up, you stride out of the room, you find someone to go mindlessly bang,
right,
and then when they glom onto your ankle, you go, woohoo, now I'm having fun.
Yeah.
So I think that they're absolute flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah. I mean, I read the Facing Love Addiction a long time ago, and all I remember is that there were love addicts and avoidance addicts.
Yeah. And I think they're usually the same person.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, I applied it to my parents who are actually, well, whatever. They're, you know, doesn't matter. But I saw both of them as extremes of each side of the coin. So, yeah. You know, obviously there are always exceptions to any rule.
Absolutely.
But, sorry.
I think it also goes in phases. And one thing that I did appreciate about P.U. Melody's insights is that she sees them as these sort of two wheels with cogs turning of the love addict and the love avoidant. They're each going through the phases of addiction and avoidance, and that they generally just mesh and then don't mesh. So that someone is pursuing, the other person is running away, then the other person stops and starts pursuing, and the other person starts running away. But somewhere in the middle there, they just enmesh so much that it seems like soulmate city until someone starts turning around and running. Because love addicts and love avoidance in the end really just aren't willing to have a deep spiritual intimate connection because we're terrified.
Do you believe that recovery changes that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you learn self-acceptance and self-love. First you have to stop doing things that hurt other people. It's amazing how bad that is for your self-worth, you know?
Yeah.
Just like, oh, I was stealing this child's time from his father because I needed him so badly to be with me. Never occurred to me that I was stealing time from a child or from a wife or from a family or that I was damaging a household. That, you know, that by being with I loved younger men. Possibly not to their, you know, possibly to their detriment. Probably not.
Yeah,
you know, probably they were fine. But, you know, did I steal time and energy that they should have spent finding an appropriate partner? You know, I mean, did I hurt someone?
Well, that's sort of on them.
And that's me. I'm not that bad with my record of wreckage, but how many women do you know that have torched guys' cars, cut up their wardrobe, boiled their bunny?
I might be the only person I know who has not checked a boyfriend's email. I feel like I know women who don't seem to have any addiction issues.
And still do that?
Yeah. I've been shocked when people have shared that with me. And sort of casually.
They may not have addiction issues, but they definitely have some boundary issues.
Yeah,
trust issues and boundary issues.
Yeah. Okay, so what was your bottom with both drugs and alcohol and sex and love? Well, we know sex and love because it happened in a rehab. Not where you were an inpatient, but in a rehab nonetheless.
Yeah, but there were many bottoms. There were times when so many people go to 12-step programs for recovery from especially love addiction just to get healthy enough so they can have a relationship. You'd be and it's just like the fact that is totally contradictory never occurs to anyone.
Right.
It's like, I'm going to recover from my need for a relationship to make me okay. Just enough to get a relationship and make me okay.
Right.
But there are so many people that get some recovery. They get a sense of their patterns. They write some inventory, get a sense of their patterns, and they stop acting out on some of the gross motor defects, you might say. And they get a little bit of time, and then they go out and they get in a relationship that is certainly way more healthy than the last four relationships, and then they stop coming to meetings, and then it creeps up and it creeps up. So my recovery has been, I don't leave recovery just because I'm in a good place. I stay in recovery because I think I need to be vigilant. I think I need to be vigilant with drugs and with alcohol and with love addiction. So in my 15 years of recovery from that stuff, I have been married and I have been divorced. And the amazing thing was that I realized, I knew before I got married that it wasn't going to fix me. And I knew when we decided mutually to separate that it wasn't going to kill me.
Right.
And that was huge. So, but I still had a lot of sadness over it and I had to work on that. I've had early in the first 5 years or so of recovery, I definitely just tried swimming in the deep end too soon. I've got it now. I can do this now and just crawled back into the rooms going like, it hurts. I just never want to be curled up on the floor in fetal position like that again.
Yeah.
And you know what that's like.
Ugh. But I know the fetal position.
I was talking
myself.
To them.
She's talking to you guys, but I know the fetal position. Trust me, I don't think anyone who gets sober doesn't know the fetal position. Mm-hmm. The like, how did you know? I can't take it. Mm-hmm. What about? So this is something that the nicotine one. I found that recovery in 12-step, in a 12-step specific nicotine program. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been able to quit without it. No, never smoked after my first meeting. And yet I haven't been in 9 years. No, I haven't been in 12 years.
Mm, fantastic.
Have no desire to smoke. And sometimes I'll see people from that program and they'll say to me, you better come back if you don't want to smoke.
I think it is one of the programs that people have the best chance of staying abstinent even without going to meetings. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's been my experience. I can go a year between meetings mm-hmm. in that program and still maintain abstinence off nicotine, because my experience was that after about 6 or 7 months, the very smell of tobacco, it's just absolutely repulsive.
Yeah.
And just smelling it on people's hair. I can smell someone smoking across the street.
Yeah.
And it just makes me want to gag. So the odds of my actually smoking again, I think, really low with or without participation in 12-step programs. I try to participate because that's working the 12-step. Someone needs to be there to keep the lights on for the new person.
Yeah.
Someone needs to be there to spread the message. I do a piss poor job of it in that particular 12-step group. Mm-hmm. But I still am grateful for it publicly a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I would have been able to make it those first 6 or 7 months. It was just, I was just so raw. I mean, how I decided to stop smoking was when I celebrated, when I took a cake for my first year mm-hmm. of abstinence off drugs and alcohol. I was so, the feelings, my then 11-year-old son, maybe he was even still 10, my little son, my little knee-high son, who's now a big man, mm-hmm. my little knee-high son gave me my first cake,
mm.
and he said he was so proud of me, and I just welled up with so much emotion. It's like my body couldn't contain them all. My mm-hmm. body could not contain all the joy and the gratitude and the regret and the sorrow and the just everything. And it was just too big for me. And I had to go outside and smoke a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt all that emotion just come down. I felt it was like putting the lid on a pressure cooker.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt it all come down. And in that moment, I just decided I don't want to block off these feelings
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to use nicotine as a way to all my life I've been using mm-hmm. I mean, since I was a teenager I've been mm-hmm. using nicotine to block the pain,
mm-hmm.
but of course it was also blocking the joy, and in that moment I was no longer willing to block the joy,
right?
So I made a decision that I was going to quit smoking, and it took me a year of prayer and meetings and writing an inventory and changing behavior and doing a million things, and then right after my 2 year anniversary, I stopped smoking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I always thought that it was interesting that, using nicotine to block emotions, because for me, piss poor help, as opposed to, say, cocaine, which for a couple years blocked them, as opposed to work, by the way, which is the most effective tool I know for blocking emotions. Nicotine, I would smoke and they really wouldn't even be blocked. Do you know what I mean?
Well, they help. Nicotine is, it's a nice anesthetic. It's a nice anesthetic. It just gives a little bit of a puffy. It just gives a little bit of a puffy cloud. It just mm-hmm. lets me see things through a little bit of a scrim.
Mm-hmm,
it just sort of dulls the edges of stuff a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I remember, Carrie White is the one. She's a previous podcast guest. Everybody mm-hmm. knows that she's a big quit smoking advocate.
She sponsors me in.
She does. She was my sponsor back when I did it. But she literally, 12-stepped me in Nicotine Anonymous. And the day after I met her at that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I never smoked again. So, she put a spell on me. That's what I think.
She's capable of that. She's a very really powerful woman.
She really is. But I remember what she said to me. One of the things she said to me that got me to go to the meeting was, you're putting a smoke screen between you and God.
Right.
And, if you just developed a spiritual program, why would you want to do that?
Okay, here's one of my favorite married lovers. I was quitting smoking, mm-hmm. and he said, "Why am I quitting smoking?" And I said, "Well, I know this may sound a little new agey, wimpy, but I'm actually quitting smoking to get closer to God."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Oh, don't be silly. God smokes." See, how can you not love that man?
Yes, seriously, full of great ideas and wisdom and all of
and
that.
And very funny.
Yeah, that's you know, who isn't a sucker for the humor?
Right.
You know, more this important
Jessica
than
Rabbit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and in terms of the bottom with drugs and alcohol, what was mm-hmm. that?
Let me see. Ah, okay. I was living with and therefore addicted to and therefore terrified of being left by a man who just happened not to drink and use. Mm-hmm. He was a hot rock and roll guitar player, and he just happened mm-hmm. not to drink or use. He wasn't sober in a program. Mm-hmm. He just didn't think that drugs and alcohol were a good idea. Mm-hmm. Go figure.
That's so weird,
and,
those
yes,
people.
I know.
Yeah, but I know tons of them now.
He was into physical health yeah. and, you know, as early adopter of the gym movement mm-hmm. and just like, and so I had to hide my using from him mm-hmm. and I kept promising him that I wasn't doing it anymore. I was in the rock and roll world. I was a rock and roll journalist. Mm-hmm. I was the editor of Rock Magazine. I mm-hmm. was a concert reviewer for Billboard. I was a correspondent for E. Yeah, that was a little later, but yeah, for E, for Daily Variety, for Hollywood Reporter, mm-hmm. I was living the whole rock and roll life, and there was enormous access to cocaine, and it was a status symbol, and I really liked it, mm-hmm. And I needed to stay thin. So, I would keep lying, and I would keep saying, oh, I'm not doing it anymore, and then I would lock myself in my own bathroom at 3 a.m. mm-hmm. and start doing lines, and the inside of my nose would hurt so much I was going to cry out in pain, and that would wake him, so I couldn't. So I would, like, do a line and then jam an ice cube up my nose mm-hmm. to numb the pain so mm-hmm. that I wouldn't have to cry out, and it didn't even occur to me. It didn't even occur to me that this was not partying behavior.
Right.
It was way, I couldn't party because I couldn't do it in public because mm-hmm. then he'd find out. So, and if, you know, if you really knew me, you would leave me. And if you leave me, I will die. Mm-hmm. You know, the basic equilibrium mm-hmm. of the crazy love addict. And he caught me one more time after I had sworn on a stack of whatever's that I wasn't going to do it anymore, and he said, you know, I'm going to leave. If you don't stop, I'm going to leave. And so I called the number in the back of the LA Weekly that said, do you have a problem with cocaine? Mm-hmm. Call this number. And I thought I was going to get a shot. I was going to be in a nice medical experiment. I thought maybe there was a class. I was hoping for a shot.
Yeah,
shot
yeah.
would be good because they're fast.
Yeah.
Pills are okay. Give me a prescription for something that's going to make me stop craving cocaine, because somehow every morning that I said, I'm not going to call the dealer, I still called the dealer. Mm-hmm. And but with the threat of losing love mm-hmm. was the only thing that was enough mm-hmm. To get me to actually walk into what turned out to be a 12-step meeting.
Mm-hmm. That was advertised in the back of the Weekly?
There used to be a classified ad in the back of the Weekly. It didn't say who. It just said, do you have a problem with cocaine? Call this number. Just as I've seen for years and not known what they were, Alcoholics Anonymous advertised in the back of newspapers that said, is drinking a problem with your life? Call this number.
I never knew that. I always think, I assume with the, like, especially with the Weekly things, that they're like, you know,
private
scammy yeah. kind of will cure you.
Many of them probably are. And I think that's what I thought it was. And I think that's what I wanted
that was
it
appealing.
To be.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted it to be.
Right.
I wanted it to be, you know, Chic Shade Elf, you know,
yeah.
10 days and you're done.
Yeah.
I said, I wanted a shot.
I wanted
a drug to cure my drug addiction.
Yeah. Lots of people do. Yeah.
And I ended up in 12-step meetings. But yes, that was a teeny little classified. It was there. I remember I had torn it out and had it in my wallet for weeks, perhaps months, and mm-hmm. it was the hotline of a 12-step program. Mm-hmm. And I called and they said, you never have to feel this way again if you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I went to one of those awful meetings mm-hmm. that I always thought was just going to be a bunch of winos.
Losers, yeah.
Winos in stained raincoats in the basement of a church. Mm-hmm. The basement of the church part was right. And it was, you know, in the first meeting I ever walked into happened to be south of Pico. So I was one of the only white faces mm-hmm. in the meeting. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's,
yeah.
oh, yeah, they're all drug addicts. But there was just, you know, I mean, anybody who's ever walked into a 12-step meeting for the first time knows that there's a sense of, the wind ain't whistling through these people the way the wind whistles through me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I want what you have. Tell me how you got it. Mm-hmm. Right from the beginning. I didn't think it had anything to do with my little cocaine problem.
Right.
It was months before I stopped using Xanax. Love Xanax. Mm-hmm. That's great for taking the edge off. Mm-hmm. Xanax. Occasional cocktail at a business meeting, mm-hmm. you know, because how can you, what are you going to be, a wuss?
You're going to
say no when the drink order comes around. By the way, I discovered that no one gives a shit.
Yeah, they really don't. They're just really, thinking about
just
themselves.
Just don't notice. No one notices. So it took a while before I decided to do it the way it was suggested. Mm-hmm. But right from the gate, it was like, there is just a warmth and an acceptance among these people that... It was just a mystery to me. I didn't have it in my family.
Yeah.
I didn't have it among my, you know, social circles. Mm-hmm. It was like, ah.
You know what I was thinking about today randomly? Did you ever see that movie? It might be called Happy. It's like it's on Netflix. It's not a full-length movie. Where it's about, or have you ever heard of, there's like this part of Japan where... I'm totally getting this wrong, where the people are the healthiest, like the people live to be 104, like the average, like, age range.
Wow.
And they go there and they explain, they interview the people and they figure out why. And one of the main things is that they have a really active community. Like, they are communal. They're constantly supporting and interacting with each other in a way that in society today we don't, and in 12-step we do.
Yes, I think so. And I think that you can do a whole biochemical read on it too if you want, because it reduces stress, and stress increases cortisol, and cortisol promotes so many horrible health effects, and you know, there's so much evidence for the advantages of community and for meditation. Mm-hmm. I mean, the things that were, whether you want to say divinely inspired or just accidentally hit upon, mm-hmm. by the originators of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, brought in everything that we've come to understand in a multimodal treatment of addiction and mm-hmm. dysfunction, that meditation, which rewires the brain, mm-hmm. and addresses the genetic and physiological component, community, which addresses the loneliness and the psychological component, and helps mm-hmm. break the obsession, mm-hmm. because you can't really... You kind of have to be alone to really obsess good. Mm-hmm. Obsessing can't be done effectively in a group.
Well, know? I wonder, though. You can be in a group and, you know, be off on your own.
You
mentally.
Can, but somehow they keep interrupting you.
Yeah.
It's like, you're always asked to participate, and it breaks your whole train of thought.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's kind of like, well, sort of like doing cocaine with a group of people who keep talking. You know what I mean? It's so awful.
Sorry, I just had a flashback. That's terrible.
Yeah, no, it was what, you know, I think it inspires many of us to do cocaine alone.
Oh yeah, I would be just like, can I just have a doggy bag and I'll just,
yeah. Did you just go into snort the cocaine?
I snorted cocaine. Never. I was not around for the, you know, Freebase was a extremely expensive elitist thing that I was never exposed to, and crack hadn't come around yet. So mm-hmm. I just got in that little powder window there.
Mm-hmm. Lucky.
Yes.
And so this whole time, but mostly in recovery, you've been publishing all these books. So we decided, you told me 9 books, I counted 11.
Okay. I think one might be a duplicate because Patently Female, which was the sequel to Mothers of Invention, which mm-hmm. is a book I co-wrote with Greg Potasik about women inventors, mm-hmm. which is a really terrific book, mm-hmm. and I'm actually proud of. Mm-hmm. And Patently Female was its sequel. Well, it was sold to one publisher who went belly up, mm-hmm. and so it was resold to a second publisher. So I think it may appear twice.
I got it.
But
got
even
it.
So, you're still up to 10 instead of 9. So, I mean, that's what I do for a living. That's what I do for. I write television and film. Mm-hmm. Is where I make money, mm-hmm. But they don't let me do it that often. And mm-hmm. then I write books because I can.
And when did you publish your first one?
Around 1984, probably.
And when did you get sober? What year?
1988.
So how much has sobriety helped your career?
That's interesting because at first I could not write at all. Mm-hmm. My first year or so of sobriety, I was absolutely blocked. Mm-hmm. I came face to face with the fear mm-hmm. that I had been, you know, subsuming into drugs and alcohol mm-hmm. and behaviors and everything else. it was all of a sudden that voice that said, you don't know how to do this, you've never known how to do this, or maybe you did know how once, but you forgot, or you ran out of stuff, the well is empty, you don't have anything else to say. All of those fears that rattle around in the head of probably every creative person, they're just like the volume got cranked up to 11, and I was paralyzed. I was paralyzed. Also, I was doing a lot of criticism. I was working as a music critic, and so a lot of what I was beloved for was being incredibly snarky. And again, you start looking at the effect you have in the world when you start working in recovery and start doing inventory. And I was realizing that I was being really mean, really, really mean to people who had tried very hard to do something creative. And who was I to cut them down? It was just I'm perfectly mean again, by the way. I mean, I understand the difference between humor and mean-spiritedness. And I can still be snarky and I can still be negative without, I think, being essentially a mean person.
Yeah, I mean, they're different. I don't, for me, I made a conscious decision to stop doing that once I started reading book reviews of my own.
I know I'm never going to make anyone else feel the way they just made me feel.
Because I don't think that I consciously realized that these were actual human beings.
It's exactly the same experience.
And then, you know, and even on Twitter, I think when Twitter first started, I would sort of be snarky, and then it's just like I made a decision. Well, and it's also, you know, just that thing, you know, deep meditators will talk about how, you know, and even in program we talk about how resenting another person, we're all, I'm you, you're me, you know, so my having a problem with somebody who's irritating me, which happens on a daily, if not hourly basis with me, is me having a problem with me. Like, if I can't show compassion, if I can't find love for that person who just drove me crazy, I can't find it for myself. We're all the same, you know.
And we've all done the same things.
But I never really got that criticizing other people is criticizing myself. You know, is just perpetuating that darkness in my heart or whatever. You know what I mean?
I do. I totally get it. And it paralyzed me for a while. And then I started writing reviews that just were sweetness and light and rainbows and unicorns. And that wasn't very helpful to the publication.
No,
so
they
needed
don't want
a little
that.
Bit of right. So I wasn't writing much at all. And then what did happen? Oh, you know what? This is interesting. In a way, I was always a journalist. I always wrote nonfiction because I wasn't. I think maybe I didn't pay enough attention to people to really be able to develop characters very well. Didn't develop rounded three-dimensional characters because I never really paid any attention to what other people on the planet were saying. When you're in that room full of, you know, cokeheads rattling on, it's just, it's not going very deep. You're not really getting much. So once I started listening to people share and being forced to shut up and listen to people share because that's the blueprint, that's the format, and especially after I quit smoking, it really made a huge difference. After I quit smoking, I was able to access more resources and more compassion for and sense of other people. And I started, I think the first screenplay I ever wrote was for the annual show, in-house show for the 12-step program. It was a humor show. It was a humor and musical thing.
What do you mean, that 12-step was putting on?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I was called upon. I was, you write, come write the show this year. And so it was performed and people laughed and had a good time and I had a great time writing it. And it's like, wow, this is a whole, and I started writing screenplays. And someone saw some of my work and said, you're really smart and really good. Would you like to come and, you know, pitch ideas to my television show? And I said, you have a television show? And he said, yeah, I've got a television. You never know who you're going to run into. And I started learning about that. And I started writing for television and found that I had what everybody says is, Ethel, you've got such a great ear. I'm considered the dialogue queen. I'm the person that can come along and make people talk like people talk. And I think a really big part of that is I listen to real people talk a lot. And not everyone has that privilege or opportunity. I've heard great stories that people tell about themselves, and I've heard people talk about how they feel about stuff, and I hear them speak in their own patois and region and idiosyncratic quirks of, mm-hmm. and I'm able to put that on the page. Mm-hmm. So it's an absolute gift, and it's mm-hmm. meant a whole other career for me mm-hmm. as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and so this is a good note to end on as we wrap up. Is there anything else that you want to tell people out there that you want to talk about yourself? We'll put a link to where they can get your book and read your blog. And what else? Is there anything else you want them to know?
Well, we were talking earlier about how hard it is to get other people to ask us questions. You
right.
think well, this, it would be
yeah,
easier.
Yeah.
And so what I would say is, if I have said anything that has caused you to come up with a question, ask me.
Yeah.
I like to interact with people. Right, you know, write to the blog. It's affectiondeficitdisorder.com. Write to the blog. Ask questions. There's a Facebook page for the book, Love Addict Book. There's mm-hmm. a Twitter feed for the book. But the main thing is, I can't think of everything you might want to know about me or mm-hmm. about addiction or about recovery. So ask. But what didn't we talk about? I am still an incredibly flawed person. It's mm-hmm. funny. I serve best as a bad example. mm-hmm. I do not want to hold myself up as a model of mm-hmm. anything. What I have is a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge of what doesn't work.
Yeah.
I'm really good at telling you what doesn't work. Like, I tried that. It doesn't work. I have gone down just about every dead end you can possibly go down and can tell you what's down there. It's a brick wall.
Yeah.
Because try everything. But I was giving my sponsor a 37-year cake, if I'm not being too specific about program stuff here. I don't want to break anyone's anonymity, certainly not my own. I stay clean and sober how I stay clean yep. and sober. It isn't necessarily how you need to stay clean and sober. But so I was celebrating the 37th anniversary of my sponsor sobriety, and we were and she was joking. She says, "And I'm still not well. Yep. I'm better, but I'm still not well." And I'm going, "Yeah, you're right. You're not."
Yeah,
we're
it's
still.
True.
It's like after 26 years. You know, she used to joke, she would say, I was hoping at least for some different character defects.
Right.
I just can have some new character defects that are not quite as unacceptable to me as my original character defects.
But they get better, you know?
I get choices on how to act on them and how mm-hmm. to not act on them.
But have you noticed, too, that one day, working and working and working on them, one day you're like, oh, my God, I didn't have that reaction. I didn't do that thing. Where sometimes all that asking and all that trying, it just, there's a shift. You're not asking. You're not trying.
It's
true. You've made the shift.
It's like, well, once a character defect no longer serves me, it evaporates. It's gone.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, what was it doing for me? What was the payoff? And when I really don't need that, when that deep need, when that hole, when that missing piece is no longer missing, and when I'm no longer reaching for that twisted survival thing because mm-hmm. I don't feel that I need it to survive, poof, it's gone.
Right.
In the meantime, all I can do is change the actions. And then, mm-hmm. like you say, I stopped acting on it, and then I stopped feeling it. Because
mm-hmm.
I think that first we stop the bad behavior, and then suddenly the impetus that led us to do that just doesn't have anything to eat.
Yeah.
And it dies.
Yeah. I mean, I should add, feel the exact same way in terms of being a model. I never want anyone to think that, like, just because we're talking about this stuff, this means, like, you should do it this way. I've done it well. You know, it sort of is like, I don't know if, do you read Chuck Palahniuk? Choke is the only book of his I read, but the, like, line he always has is, like, what would Jesus not do? Those have been a lot of my choices. And so, you know, speaking from the experience of that rather than speaking from the experience of I know all, you know, I only know the mistakes I've made.
Right.
You know, bouncing back from them, finding new ways. So, okay, so you have been a delight. I can't thank you enough for doing this.
Thank you so much for asking me.
And you're definitely going to be one of our experts. I figured out what you're going to do for us as we've been talking.
Okay.
It's exciting. So, you know, don't mean to leave it on a cliffhanger, guys, but you'll be seeing Effie on the site. So thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
So that was Effie Ann Bear on After Party pod. Hope you liked it. If you're liking this podcast, please go and subscribe. It's so easy. Yes, a 5-star review is wonderful, but so is just clicking subscribe. I mean, it's such a small thing. Who knew it could make such a big difference? It does. So thank you. Keep emailing. Love the emails. See you next time.